The House Local Government Committee will come to order. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Bertolio.
Here.
Vice Chair Cohenour.
Present.
Representative Bishop.
Excused.
Representative Galloway.
Present.
Representative Gist.
Here.
Representative Gunderson.
Here.
Representative Cordham.
Here.
Representative Springer.
Excused.
Representative Zolnikoff.
Here.
Representative Thane.
Here.
Representative Rexton.
Here.
Representative Seekins-Crow.
Excused.
Representative Lynch.
Here.
Representative Essman.
Here.
Representative Kearns.
Excused.
Chair Brewster.
Excused.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Springer just arrived.
Oh, thank you.
Here.
All right, a few announcements before we get started. Please silence your cell phones. If you must take a call, please step outside of the committee room. If you wish to give testimony, please sign in at the door, providing your name and affiliation, if any. Please note that the information in your testimony is public record. The following bills have been scheduled for hearing today: House Bill 324, House Bill 360, and House Bill 369. We will now hear House Bill 324, sponsored by Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Local Government Committee. I am Representative Caleb Hinkle from House District 68, South Belgrade. I want to first start and tell you about the inspiration about House Bill 324 and where this idea came from. Last spring, there was a massive push to gather signatures and place on the ballot CI 121, which was essentially a property tax cap modeled after California's controversial Proposition 13. As I studied more into the idea of the singular tax cap, I came to the conclusion that a singular tax cap is not the solution to our constituents' skyrocketing taxes, especially property taxes. Unchecked city and county spending is. This is where, through research, I discovered Colorado's highly successful and praised TABOR, or Taxpayer Bill of Rights system. So praised, in fact, that it has a 72% approval rating among the electorate. What House Bill 324 essentially does is cap city-county spending based on population and adjust with the average inflation rate. I would especially like to note that this would only affect the first-class cities and counties and consolidated city-counties with more than 20,000 residents. So small towns and rural counties will not be affected by House Bill 324. While the cities and counties have balanced budget, a balanced budget doesn't always mean a good budget. Spending every dollar that comes in does not imply that the spending is appropriate. If we want fiscal restraint, we need to define what that means. This bill does that by focusing on limitation on spending rather than a limitation on revenue. There is nothing stopping the cities and counties from exceeding the budget in terms of spending, sometimes at the rate of 30 or 40%. House Bill 34 would put this much-needed limit in place. After speaking with many of you on this committee, as well as others in both House and Senate, I have an amendment that would, I believe, addresses most of your concerns. The amendment is roughly as follows: combines existing mill levy language in Section 2, exempt the money that is above the population plus inflation into an emergency savings account or paying on existing debts incurred prior to 2023, exempt moving money out of an emergency savings account during recession to back revenues lower than expenditure limitation, and I request to hand out this amendment, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
House Bill 24, Montana's Taxpayer Bill of Rights, is the correct step to addressing wasteful spending, and thank you all. Yield to proponents.
All right, before we get started, please state and spell your name and who you represent for the record. If you have any exhibits or written testimony, please give those to the secretary. Please do not read your testimony or repeat what has already been said. And I think there are a lot of people, and so I'd like to try to do 30 minutes of proponents and 30 minutes of opponents, please. And with that, I'll open it up to proponents.
Good
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Ramos. I am a former city councilman from Missoula, Montana, and I am the CED for Americans for Prosperity Montana. My name is J-E-S-S-E. Last name is R-A-M-O-S. So I just wanted to start by saying it is an honor to be here testifying for this bill. After serving the Missoula City Council for 4 years, I was constantly looking for different ways that I could help my constituents from being taxed out of their homes. I was constantly looking for different ways that I could explain the budgeting process in such a way that the average citizen could understand. Because the problem with the budget is that it is so difficult and so comprehensive that the ordinary citizen has no idea what they're paying for, where their taxes are coming from, how the valuation of their mill is calculated, or even how their mill is calculated. So it's really opaque, and it's really hard to have citizen participation. And this is the best bill that I have ever seen that addresses the issue without punishing cities that are doing a good job, and also without punishing cities at all. And the reason for that is because this bill is simply about transparency. It's simply about simplifying the process so that the average constituent and the average person can easily understand how much they're paying to the government, whether that's through a fine, a fee, a surcharge, a tax, a special assessment, a tax increment financing, any number of things. So, Madam Chair, may I pass out a handout for the committee?
Please do.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So I just wanted to start by a ballot measure that was a passed that was passed and approved by the citizens of Montana in 1986, I-103. It was actually amended and fixed a little bit in 1999 by the state legislature. But what that did is it set a cap on the growth of the mill levies to one half the rate of inflation over 3 years, without getting into the weeds too much on that. And since that time, unfortunately, we've seen a bunch of different games, as I would like to call them, that the cities have played to kind of skirt that cap. So, first of all, back to the budgeting process, I just wanted to back up on it before I get into all this detail that you'll see right in front of you. So I've been in wealth management for 8 years. I was on the city council for 4 years, and it took me probably, 14, 15 hours to try and break down these sheets in a way that you guys could all understand it. So if it took me a long time to develop these sheets for you guys who are very influential and very informed folks, how does the average citizen feel when they're trying to understand these various types of funds and taxing methods and fee methods and permit methods? It makes it very, very difficult. So back to my original point, I want to just show you, if you'll turn to this page in your packets, it's got a little construction worker on it, and it's got a park on it, a little tree for a park district. So these are one of the biggest ways that the cities have really taken advantage of the open system that they have right now and their way of subverting the cap set by the state legislature. And on the record, when I was on city council, the mayor and the city council referred to this, quote unquote, as cap management. They would talk about utilizing special districts and other things, and they would call it cap management. So explicitly saying that they were trying to subvert the will of the voters and the will of the state legislature to cap the growth of the mill levies. So the first way they do it is by these special districts. So in 2011, Missoula created two special districts, and they created these special districts not by a vote, but by sending every taxable property in the city a postcard. If they didn't get enough of these postcards back, these districts were automatically created. So it was kind of like reverse voting. It was a little weird, but in any event, they started in 2011. The park district was $200,000. And as you can see, in 2022, that was levied at $7.5 million. That represents a growth rate of 3,500% or 318% annualized. The road district was started at $300,000, and this year was levied at $6.8 million. That is a growth rate of 2,100%, and that is 199% annually. This is all underneath the cap of the mill levies that we currently have right now. So the system we have is not working, unfortunately. And let's take a look at another big issue with the mill levy cap that's addressed with this bill, and that's on this page of this handout. And that is just the fact that we now have a two-year appraisal cycle, and we have the Department of Revenue coming out with new appraisals every year. every 2 years. I apologize. So I just wanted to run through this. I know there's some freshmen on the committee, and I know that this is, again, a complicated process to go through. So this is how a property tax bill is actually calculated. So the first step that you have to do is you have to identify what your property is valued at by the DOR. So in my example, I have that at $325,000. I then multiply that number by 1.35%, which is a rate set by all you guys for residential properties. And then I get my taxable value. That's $4,387. I simply divide that by 1,000, and that gives me the value of my mill. So for year 2022, my mill is worth $4.38. So the mayor or the city commission or the county commissioners, they charge me by the mill to live in the city. So in 2022, the mayor charges me 100 bucks or 100 mills to live in the city times $4.38. That's 438 bucks to live in the city of Missoula. All pretty straightforward. And then we'll flip that page over. It will depict the exact same scenario, but the DOR has increased the value of that property by 18%. I'm using that as an example because that happened my last year on council. So the value of the mill goes up by 18%. The market value is now $383,000, an 18% increase. And now we'll skip through the rest of it, and we'll see that the value of the mill is $5.17. So the value of the mill is up by 18%. And then the mayor, he wants to be very generous. So he says that he's going to lower everybody's property taxes. So he lowers the mills levied by 3% down to 97 mills. But wait a minute. The amount that I owe to the city is $501 over, which is 14% higher than they levied against me in 2020. So the mayor is able to claim he's lowering property taxes while simultaneously raising them by 14%. This is not addressed by the cap. This is addressed by the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. So the next thing that I wanted to show you guys, so in addition to the special districts and the valuation game that these cities play, they also have this. This is 425 pages of revenue sources from the city of Missoula. This includes anywhere from chicken licenses to pyrotechnic permits to critically detrimental issues such as building permits. So all of those building permits, those impact fees, all of those things that are passed on to the customer that are driving this affordable housing crisis, these are all compiled in this. And sorry, I didn't want to print all of this off for every member of the committee. Wanted to save the trees.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, but I will pass this around so you guys can take a look at it. But that's what but that's what happens when it's just the mill levies cap. These cities find other ways to come up with this money, and it's all coming out of the same pot. It's all coming from the taxpayers. So I will wrap it up here. I appreciate the extra time that you've given me. So in your package, you will also find a list of some things that Missoula has spent their money on. So I know we're going to hear from some opposition that the cities really need this money. So we'll see on this list of spending fees, they spend about $320,000 a year to pay a group called Missoula in Motion to encourage people to ride the bus and ride a bike. $320,000 a year. They gave $7 million as an incentive to Southgate Mall. They spent $5 million on a heated walking bridge over the city, over the Reserve Street. They gave a $53,000 incentive to First Security Bank. They gave a $1.5 million incentive to Stockman Bank, plus the interest on that, which, by the way, we borrowed the money to give to Stockman Bank from Stockman Bank. And then we also gave them another $459,000 of money for their other bank. So these are the type of things that Missoula is spending their money on. You will also find in here, it's just kind of an explanation of what the local taxpayer bill of rights is. I have had the chance the chance to talk to MACO, and we're working through some issues on it, some things that we want to make sure works with them. I know we're not going to see eye to eye on all the issues, but we definitely want to make sure that it is as congruent as possible. So in closing, the opposition is going to say that this takes power away from local governments, but what it actually does is empower the voters to have a say on what an appropriate budget is. So all this does is it caps the growth of the budget to the rate of inflation plus population for the previous year, which is a very generous figure, considering that right now the growth of the mill levy is one half the rate of inflation over 3 years. And if you want to go above and beyond that, that's easy. You just ask the voters. So in a democracy, you'll just go and ask the voters and you'll make your case as to why that money is needed. So the opposition is going to try to confuse you by explaining this is a complicated process. It is. It's an incredibly complicated process. You can see by all these handouts and sheets and 400 pages. That's what this does, is it simplifies it so the voters know exactly how much money is going to their government, and they can choose whether they want it to get bigger or smaller. And my last point is they say this will mean more debt, as we talked about. We have an amendment in the bill that would create better incentives to pay off debt, save and equalize budgets in the worst case scenarios. I appreciate your time and giving me some extra time, and I'm available for questions.
Are there other proponents in the room?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kendall Cotton, Cotton spelled C-O-T-T-O-N. I'm the president and CEO of the Frontier Institute. We're a free market think tank based right here in Helena, and I'm pleased to offer our support for this bill today. I do have an additional handout. It's just one page, but I'd like to hand that out with the chair's permission.
Go ahead, please.
Local governments often blame inflation as the key culprit for tax increases. But from my perspective, the truth is that the crushing property tax burdens felt around Montana are a direct consequence of the years of reckless local government spending in this state. Frontier Institute's 2023 Real Local Budgets report shows that that most major local government budgets have far exceeded the growth of population plus inflation over the last 10 years, leaving taxpayers on the hook for millions in excessive spending. You'll see on my handout that I just sent around some excerpts from that report showing, for example, that the city of Missoula's budget, the rate of growth of the city of Missoula's budget is 70% higher than the growth of population plus inflation. If inflation was really the main reason driving Missoula's budgets higher over time, there would be far less spending than there is now. Had Missoula's city and county governments both passed fiscally responsible budgets for the last 10 years, limiting spending growth to no more than population plus inflation, as this bill prescribes, combined they would have spared taxpayers nearly $103 million in excessive spending in fiscal year 22. Contrast that with what the state of Montana is doing. Thanks to the leadership of many of you last legislative session, the state passed a conservative budget that successfully kept spending growth below the trend of population growth plus inflation for the biennium. This fiscal responsibility has made room for historic state tax relief. Not so at the local level, where we are seeing record property tax increases. One of the issues that we've identified is that the state has a statutory spending limit in Title 17, while local governments do not have a spending limit in statute. HB 324 will correct this imbalance, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other proponents in the room?
Ann Hollowell. A-N-N-H-A-L-L-O-W-E-L-L. I'm a member of the public. Madam Chairman, committee members, I support HB 324. Anything we can do to reduce the percentage of the economy consumed by government is good. I do, however, find Section 1-6 on page 2 concerning. This bill promotes fiscal responsibility. Why would we want to undermine that goal by exempting smaller cities and counties from the same fiscal responsibility? Please consider striking Section 1-6 and give the same good standards to all Montana cities and counties. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I leave a copy of testimony?
Sure. Thank you. Any other proponents in the room?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darren Gaub. Last name is spelled G-A-U-B as in boy, and I come on behalf of two organizations in support of this bill. The first one is Restore Liberty, an organization I co-founded and am the national spokesman for. We have chapters across the state of Montana and tens of thousands of memberships and fans across the nation. The other organization is the Montana Freedom Caucus. As a priority bill, this is one of them. Basically, we don't need to continue to grow government through increased, complicated taxation and sleight of hand. As a resident of Helena, I know I'm all too familiar with the idea of let's spend everything we have and then go back and continuously ask for more, and rather than be disciplined in our spending and actually live by a budget. So in an era of rising property costs, property taxes, and the cost of living in general, and the simple fact that families have to live within budgets, and we believe that governments should live within budgets too at all levels, again, we want to support this bill, both organizations, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gaub. Any other proponents in the room?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Terry Nelson, N-E-L-S-O-N. I'm a citizen of Ravalli County, and this bill, unless the good lady's amendment actually passed, doesn't necessarily affect us. However, I know that in Hamilton, taxes are about 40% more than just outside it, which is a little shocking to me. But what happens in Missoula always affects Ravalli County. And we are seeing a lot of people. I was the planner for 12 years in Ravalli County, and we have a lot of people from Missoula that started moving into Ravalli County because they work in Missoula and couldn't afford Missoula anymore. I think this is a good bill. Please pass.
Thank you. Any other proponents in the room?
My name is Alexa Chevarria, C-H-A-V-A-R-R-I-A. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for listening to my testimony. I live in Missoula. I'm a single mom of three. And earlier I heard Missoula referred to as the poster child for poor tax spending. And I think there are examples of that all over the state. I like this bill because it creates transparency and the ability for ordinary citizens like myself to understand where our tax dollars are going. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other proponents in the room? Proponents in the room. Proponents online. None. Okay, let's go to opponents in the room.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Jason Strofe, last name S-T-R-O-U-F as in Frank. I'm the immediate past president of MACO, and by such, I sit on the executive board of MACO, and I stand in front of you today speaking on behalf of that same executive board. While we are very supportive of finding constructive and viable legislation to ease the burden on property tax owners, this bill does not do that. So I'm asking you for a no vote, and I would like to introduce Executive Director Eric Bryson to speak in more detail in regards to why this bill does not do what has been said it does.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bryson. That's B-R-Y-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm going to try and be helpful in this and give some constructive criticism to the bill and the mechanics of the bill. I want to start with a suggestion for an additional definition that I think needs to happen, and it's the term total expenditures. We need a definition for that. Is an expenditure a planned spend or an actual spend? As we create preliminary budgets and final budgets in local governments, we use the term expenditure to define that preliminary budget and a planned expenditure. But this bill triggering certain things that happen if we overexpend based on the thresholds constructed in the bill needs a definition for what that means. Is it the preliminary budget? Is it the final budget as adopted? Or is it the actual cutting of the check that crosses that threshold? Well, I also, because of the way counties work, we need an exception for intergovernmental transfers. Counties, act as the bank for a lot of entities that we are directly associated with and some that we are not. We take the money collected in property taxes and we give it to entities like the high school district, which is totally separate and distinct from us, but we also give it to the weed district, which is a component of us. So the finances that run through the county books are varied and differential, and this bill doesn't address that. It looks at total expenditures year over year for entities that we may be responsible for and we may not be responsible for. So we need to separate those out, given that tax collector status that we have. In that section, because it doesn't define, and we use that general term undefined as total expenditures, we do need that specific carve out. There needs to be a distinguishment between levied funds and special purpose funds. Counties levy for things like the weed district or the public safety levy or general fund that comes from your ad valorem property taxes, and this bill doesn't make any distinction between any of those. We also have assessments, rural improvement districts, weed districts, fire service areas, fire districts, of which we are sometimes responsible for and sometimes we're not. Fire districts in particular have their own board of trustees, their own management, adopt their own budgets, but their finances flow through the county books. So we need a distinction between those to make sure that when the county exceeds the thresholds that are in this, or the fire district exceeds the thresholds in this, we know which entity has to call for the election and make the request to have that excess ratified by the voters. This bill doesn't do that. And when do we call for the election? I understand that there's amendments. They were posted this afternoon. I read the amendments, but it doesn't give enough clarity for when that call for election needs to happen. Do we do it once we know that the expenditures will cross the threshold that the bill proposes? I'm not sure. Is that in the preliminary budget? Is that in the final budget? Is that when the check is cut that threshold is cut, is crossed? And again, because we are the taxing entity in the bank for certain entities, if the fire district buys a new truck that brings the county over that threshold limit, does the county call for the election or does the fire district call for the election? That needs clarified in this bill. Obligation of funds sometimes happens in that the funds are set aside in reserve for that expenditure. Is obligation of the funds the time that could trigger the election? And again, it varies depending on who the entity is that's making those obligation of funds or expenditures. To be fair to the sponsor, the election portion of this bill makes sense when a county knows that their planned preliminary budget is likely to cross the threshold contained in Section 1, Sub A and Sub B. But even then, when does the county submit the question to the voters? Do they adopt a resolution calling for a special election at the adoption of the preliminary budget? I don't think so. It's a preliminary budget. Do they do it at the final budget? And for you that don't know, in local government, final budget adoption has to be approved by resolution the latter of the first Thursday after the first Tuesday in September or within 30 calendar days of receiving certified values from the Department of Revenue. We adopt annual operating budgets applicable July 1 in September. We backdate our budgets in. And the reference in the amendments talked about elections under 1510-425, which calls for special elections for mill levies and voting purposes. To call for a special election under 1510-425, you have to give 85 days notice from the resolution of intent to call the election. If we adopt our budget in September, we don't have 85 days to get that on the general or primary election. That needs to be sorted out. That could be done in defining how the election happens. It could be done in the amendments by amending the amendments to specify how, when, and where that call for election needs to happen. But it needs to be fixed. Counties have operations that are structured like a business. We call them enterprise funds. Our auditors call them enterprise funds. My favorite example is a nursing home. In the middle of a year, your nursing home could be low below the threshold that you need to break even or make money and then see an increase in census. That increase in census is going to be commensurate with an increase in revenues, but also an increase in costs associated with taking care of the folks that are there. If the enterprise fund needs to be able to spend the money they're generating on occupants and beds for the care of the folks that are there, we can't wait 85 days to ask for an election to have a deviation from the spending limits placed in this entity. There needs to be a specific carve-out for all enterprise funds. I talked to at least some proponents about that in advance. They thought that that was in the bill, but it's not. Carving out enterprise funds would be really important. What about catastrophic failures in essential systems like water and sewer, or using reserves to stock up on sandbags in advance of a flood? We can't wait 85 days for a special election to be able to respond to the necessities of emergencies and disasters and essential service delivery. So there needs to be a carve out for emergencies. The bill is in the original draft did make a reference to the governor's ability to declare a disaster or emergency and make exceptions for spending under that, but surprisingly didn't reference 10.3.402, a local government's ability to declare a disaster or emergency and then waive the limitations for expenditures during that disaster. I would ask that that be included in the bill as well. Subsection 1, sub 5 states that, quote, any revenue collected in excess of the expenditure limitations provided in this section must be subtracted from the total amount of revenue authorized to be raised by property tax collections under 1510.420 for the subsequent year. What revenue? Ad valorem property tax revenue, intergovernmental transfers, money from special district assessments, voted levies, fee for services. What revenue? I think the intent of the bill is to say what the government is spending in total from fees, assessments, whatever, property taxes is capped. We'll get to that problem, but that there needs to be a definition in this bill for what revenue they're talking about. The most heavily reliant fund in general government is the general fund, and it relies on property taxes. If we're talking about limiting property taxes and having a mechanism where revenue caps or expenditure caps are dedicated and directed to property taxes and then poured back into the property tax calculation in subsequent years, this bill needs to be entirely limited to the general fund property taxes. We need that in the definition. So here's the list of things that we need to do to try and fix this bill and identify the technical difficulties. Define expenditures as either planned or spent. Carve out intergovernmental transfers. Treat levied funds differently than all other sources of revenue. Distinguish between those entities that flow through the county books and those that don't. Identify the trigger point for the call for election. Identify which entity is responsible for calling for the election if it happens to be a sub-entity of the county. Clarify when the election needs to be held and what information needs to be given to the voters to make an informed decision. Remove the election costs, carve out the enterprise funds entirely, add an exception to locally declared disasters, and the 2 mil emergency levy, exempt the use of funds accrued through authorized capital improvement funds, and you'll have addressed most of the technical aspects of this bill. Two other things I want to point out. The legislature was gracious enough in the past to give us the ability to generate money in coal trusts and hard rock mining. We can only spend those monies when the mining stops, so we can't spend any of that. And then when the mines shut down, we have the ability to implement some services and spend, which was going to seem like an anomaly year over year for those very specific purposes. You need to carve out those two as well. You don't need to. I'm asking you to carve out those two as well to make this bill workable. Ad valorem property taxes are already capped at half the rate of inflation using last year's actually assessed as a starting point. That's what we do in local government. That's the limitation. We are revenue limited. So this bill's main premise that the revenues collected from all the sources that a county collects will be a limiting factor in next year's calculation for property taxes under 1510.420 is fundamentally flawed. Excess revenue from the landfill enterprise can't legally go to buy down mills in the countywide tax base. Neither can the weed district, fire district, or public safety mill levy. You can't take dedicated mills, fees, services, identified funds, and pour them into the calculation in subsequent years under 1510.420. It's not legal. Procedurally, it's not possible either. And each fund is restricted by statute to hold no more than one-third of budgeted expenditures year over year in the county. So there's not excess funds in the county's balance sheet. If we've planned and saved and want to do a bridge replacement for money that we've saved over years through either a dedicated levy or general fund, and the voters turn us down, that money has to go back into your capital improvement plan. If your levied fund for the weed district wants to buy equipment, but that crosses the threshold and the voters say no, that money has to go to the weed district. If it's your solid waste district that wants to buy a new a crusher or wants to expand a new component on the solid waste, that money has to stay with the solid waste district. It cannot go to buy down mills in a subsequent year as this bill proposes. It's not possible. County budgets are adopted after a hearing on the preliminary budget. It's open and available to the public. They're voted on in public by commissioners, elected by the public and serving at the pleasure of the public. Representing the residents, I want to make sure that we point that out, that they do represent the residents in the county. Those budgets are done at a noticed and posted hearing on the final budget. The final budget sets the expenditure limitations based on a balanced budget requirement set forth in statute. Your expenditures cannot exceed the revenues and reserves. Substantive amendments to the budget, like granting additional expenditure authority, requires another hearing and amendment to the budget. And then this bill, after all that, adds an opportunity for the public to weigh in and sort of like a referenda to validate the decision that their elected representatives have made in a public process to adopt that ongoing budget. And then, strangely, pours this money back into property tax reductions in subsequent years. And then I finish with this, I promise. What resets the base? What resets the base? According to this bill, the local government whose voters approved a deviation under Section 1 by voting to approve will have next year's base level be the current plus the voter improved. So they have a new base that's higher because the voters approve that. And then on top of that, they get to add the formula under Sub B. I'm not sure that that accomplishes the goal of the proponents of this bill. So redefine the base and how that works if we're going to fix this bill. As you saw in the fiscal note, this impacts Yellowstone, Missoula, Gallatin, Flathead, Cascade, Lewis and Carker Valley, Silver Bow Lake, and Lincoln County. The fiscal note, which was just posted today, too, also indicates some of the technical problems with this. You cannot pour dedicated, specific funding in county government into property tax reductions in subsequent years. If you were going to do that, you'd have to limit this bill entirely to the general fund and ad valorem property taxes generated from 15-10-420. The entire bill needs to be rewritten. And as I talked to proponents before, I would be happy to sit down with them and identify ways that in Montana, we have processes in place that you could come up with a theory to cap year over year both revenues and expenditures. But you can't take a Colorado bill and slap it in Montana and make it work, and that's what this bill does. Please vote no.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson. Any other opponents?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Daryl James. That's D-A-R-R-Y-L. James is the common spelling. I'm the executive director for the Montana Infrastructure Coalition. Madam Chair, members, I think we could agree with a couple of things behind this bill. First of all, we've heard it, you've heard it, your constituents are concerned about their property taxes. There's no question. I think we can also agree on the need for maybe some more transparency, some more accountability at the local government level. But I think our agreement with this bill stops there. I think this bill is built on a false premise and a misleading narrative that that property taxes are growing at an exorbitant rate, and that it's all on out-of-control local government spending. I've got a handout that I'd like to get to, but I want to start with, and I do this every time, and I need to bring a graphic, but you're going to have to stick with me with these, my little bar chart here. So real basic understanding of how property taxes grow. Right? You start with your base year, which was last year. 15-10-420 gives you a growth of a half the rate of inflation average over the last 3 years. Then you add on newly taxable, which is new development and reappraisals. That's your new budget. The only way it grows, actually there's two ways that we started talking about in tax. The first is a voted levy. So those taxpayers are asking for a new roof on the school, a new detention facility, a new parks and rec bond. The voters get to say, we could agree on that part too, that a democracy and their property taxes make sense. It's already there, right? The only other way property taxes grow is when you pass another bill that results in a tax shift. We've talked about this in the tax committee the last couple of weeks. There have been several measures which are good public policy. We're providing tax abatements for veterans, disabled veterans, low-income populations, business equipment tax cuts. All of those result in a tax shift onto your residential property taxpayers that are complaining to you about their property taxes. Okay? That's how property tax burdens grow in Montana. Okay? Madam Chair, I've got a handout I'd like to pass out.
Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, we've got Terry Johnson's a former legislative services fiscal analyst doing some work for us. He's built a model that will help us break down individual communities, counties, cities and towns across Montana. But I thought before we got into all that, I'd just go to the biennial report. This is a few pages from the Department of Revenue's biennial report that provide a pretty accurate picture of what's going on with taxes in Montana. If you look at that first page with the line graphs, The two top lines are property taxes and income taxes. As you're all fully aware by this point, property taxes largely fund local governments, income tax funds state government. You can see the top line is property taxes in 1980, about 4.25% of GDP, right? So over the last 40 years up to 2020, property taxes are down to 3.75% of GDP. So a decline as a percentage of GDP. You look at income tax, went from 2% of GDP in 1980 to roughly 3.25% in 2020. So a pretty good increase in income taxes over the last 40 years. Drop to the next line chart at the bottom of the page. This is per capita total taxes adjusted for inflation. So in 1980, total tax burden in property taxes was about $1,750 per capita. That grew to about $1,900 in 2020. That's a 24% increase over 40 years. Now look at income tax. Went from $900 up to, let's just pull that back to 2020. We'll ignore that spike. That goes up to about $900 to $1,000. That's an 87% increase. So if we want to talk about out-of-control spending, out-of-control growth, let's compare those two. If this is good for local governments, why is it not also good for state government? There's a much more dramatic increase in state government revenue growth and spending than there is at the local level. So I'll leave you to ponder that one. Let's go to the next page, though. Look at trends in state and local government revenue sources. Okay, start at the bottom. Property taxes in that rosy color there. In 2000, it was about 18.7%. Today, it's about 18.3%. It's fluctuated down from 15, 16 to 18. No real change over the last 20 years. You can see that across the board. Individual and income, corporate income tax, risen a little bit. Fuel taxes hasn't really changed. Severance tax is pretty flat. Sales and excise tax is pretty flat. Transfer from federal government, those have been increasing over the last few years. All pretty flat trend lines in revenue sources, okay? Flip to the next page, page 14. So this is the local spending in Montana, state and local spending. If you look at spending on public schools in 2000, it was 26% of total spending. It's down to 22%. So we've seen a decrease in spending in schools. Higher education, 10.6 down to 9.3. Health and Human Services up from 20% to roughly 30%. So that's the only area you're going to see significant growth over the last 20 years in our spending. Again, public safety up from 7.2 to 8. Now let's look at the ones that are really about infrastructure spending in Montana. Transportation, housing, natural resource parks. Those went from 12% down to 10, 8.5% down to 7.5%. So we're seeing a decrease in the spending on the things that some people are questioning on the ballot and saying, why are we voting on an open space bond? That's frivolous, it's unnecessary. I won't argue with that point, but if we're talking about water sewer upgrades, road and bridge upgrades, that falls in those categories which are declining. And that's what we're asking voters to vote for and approve when we're growing local government budgets. So if you look at these trends and your constituents are complaining about their property tax burdens, I got to ask, how do we compare with neighboring states? Where are we with our neighbors and their tax structures? Because I'm wondering if it's not more of a structural problem than it is a spending problem. So if you look at the last page here with the pie charts, the first one shows state and local taxes. Again, this is the revenue side. Montana gets about 40% of its total revenue, both state and local, from property taxes. About 30% is income tax. The rest of those sales, motor fuels, corporate income tax, all in the 9-10%, 4-5 to 10%. Look at neighboring states. Idaho has a sales tax, so they've got a pretty even 30-30-30 split between property, income, and sales tax. Wyoming does not have an individual income tax, but they do have a larger share of their income comes from severance tax. But their property tax is about the same, about 40%. South Dakota, again, about 40% in property tax, roughly 50% in sales tax, no individual income tax. North Dakota, very heavy reliance on severance taxes, lower income and property taxes. When you look at the national average, again, we're a little higher than average on property taxes, pretty average with regard to income tax, but again, a reliance on sales tax. I don't see anything wildly out of whack here with our system. The only way that you're going to put downward pressure on property taxes is to look at a sales tax. And we can talk about that all day if you'd like. Now let's look at the last page, state and local spending. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. You can look at it pretty easily and see that we're not wildly out of whack with any of our neighboring states or national trends on where that money is spent. So the notion that local governments are spending like drunken sailors, that the taxpayers are left out of the equation, is simply a false and misleading narrative. The taxpayers are involved in those decisions on what they want to fund in their local communities. Our current system, as far as putting stuff on the ballot, allowing those taxpayers to vote for themselves what they want in their communities and to prioritize the investments they want in their communities, is working. But I do think that we need to look at a long-term overhaul of our overall tax structure, and that involves that hard conversation about how do you put downward pressure on property taxes. And the only way we can really do that is to tap those 12 million visitors to the state of Montana that put strain on our infrastructure, our police and fire protection, our roads and bridges, our water sewer systems, by imposing some kind of a statewide sales tax. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other opponents in the room?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Local Government Committee. My name is Carter Marsh, M-A-R-S-H. I'm here on behalf of Montana Firemen's Association. I'm currently a firefighter in the city of Great Falls. Montana firefighters stand opposed to House Bill 324 due to the budgetary restrictions this bill would impose upon municipalities. I think we've hit that pretty hard in the other opponent categories. I'd like to say that I think this bill would increase the amount of ballot measures that we would see, and I think it would lead to some voter burnout at the ballot box. I just want to go over some figures with you real quick as far as what I see in my line of work on costs and what we're up against when we're building a budget for a fire department. So our turnout sets, which is consisted of our coats and our pants, in 2020, that was $2,660 to outfit one person. Today, that is $3,318. That's a 24% increase over 2 years. Our boots, $455 in 2020. Today, they are $583. That's a 28% increase. Our helmets in 2020 are $300. Today, they're $418. That's a 40% increase for a total cost of $4,319. That's a 26% increase in the last 2 years to outfit one person on our fire department. Our apparatus costs, in 2017, we bought a truck. It was a used demo truck. It was $477,000. We bought another one of the same specs. It was a used demo in 2020 for $498 at a 4% increase. Today, we got a spec for that truck, and that used demo truck is $700,000, just a hair over, and that's a 40% increase that we're seeing. So I believe that this bill would force cities to go to the voters just to purchase essential pieces of equipment that we have to have to do our jobs. And most of these purchases are not done annually. Our apparatus purchases can be 5, 10, even 20 years apart, and this gives time for the municipalities to save up for these large purchases, which in this bill, but with a one-time large expenditure, would penalize the city the next year by not allowing those taxes to be collected to make up for the difference. So anyways, I'd like you to take all that into consideration. We are up against a large amount of inflation right now, and these are just a small glimpse of the essentials that we need to do our jobs in public safety. So I'd vote in opposition to this. Thanks for your time.
All right. Any other opponents?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kelly Lynch, L-Y-N-C-H. I am the executive director of the Montana League of Cities and Towns. I don't think I could say any more than Eric, who I only heard a couple of words in that very fast presentation, and Daryl, who did a great overview of how property taxes work in Montana. I'm going to speak just a little bit to the costs of what we do in local government. When you, your husband, your wife, your kid, something happens to them, you call 911, that fire truck, those firemen, that EMS, the roads they drive on to get there, the call system, that is all paid for with your property taxes. When you flush the toilet, you don't have to deal with what happens after that. There are miles of pipes and pumps that take your waste to a wastewater treatment plant, a multi-million dollar tertiary treatment, wastewater treatment plant that is required by EPA standards, and it deals with all of that for you. When you send your kid to school for 12 years, day in and day out, they play football afterwards, and they take the bus to school, all of that is paid for with your property taxes. We're not talking about little things. These things are very expensive, and I think that the firemen spoke very clearly to the issues of raising costs over time. But I just wanted to kind of put a realistic view of what we're talking about here, because that is what cities and towns do. They provide services to all of your constituents. We are already limited by the half the rate of inflation over the past 3 years average, and anything over and above that is voted mill levies. The residents are asked whether or not they want to pay for something, whether or not it's an improvement to your water supply system or it's a heated bridge. Whatever your community is that they're interested in doing, those are the things that go to the voters, and the voters make that decision. That's not something we're allowed to just do. The legislature has reduced the tax rate on almost all other classes of property over the past 20 years. And as Mr. James pointed out, that puts increasing pressure on class four property. Every time you do one of those great bills that help someone, it hurts residential and commercial taxpayers because those mills get spread over everyone else. I'll just point out an issue with population. The EPA doesn't care how many people we're treating. They care that we meet the nutrient standards. When we lose population, that's not going to affect what standards we have to meet with the EPA. We're still going to have to operate and maintain those facilities in the same way. It's not going to be affected by losing 1,000 people in our community. I'll just end by saying it's not an accurate narrative. What is happening with property taxes. I hope that you've listened to some of the information that you received today. We are at the table to talk with you about how we can figure out the issues with property tax, but this is not the answer. We ask for a do not pass. Thanks.
Any other opponents?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shelby DeMars, that's D-E-M-A-R-S, and today I'm here on behalf of both the Montana Association of Oil, Gas, and Coal Counties, as well as the Montana Police Protective Association. Since I feel like all of the county points have been very, very adequately made, I'll focus more on the Police Protective Association points. A couple things that I'm very, very concerned about with this bill is that if you look at the threshold that's set on this for spending. If you have an emergency situation and we have a patrol vehicle that's totaled, a lot of our departments have a very set number of patrol vehicles, and they can only have as many officers out patrolling as they have vehicles for those officers. So if we have a vehicle that's totaled and the local government has hit that threshold, we would have to wait to go to the voters, pass that levy, and then order that patrol vehicle, which then takes an additional, 6 months or more to get that patrol vehicle outfitted with all the appropriate material for that officer to get that officer back on the street. So in that instance, we're actively, you couldn't very realistically be keeping police off the street in that particular instance. Not only that, I have additional concerns about how this would impact how departments request and reserve training spots at the Law Enforcement Academy. Currently, depending on the agency's staffing needs, they go ahead and reserve spots at the Law Enforcement Academy months and months in advance. What happens if they reserve a spot, they hit their spending cap? Are they able to pay for those officers to go to the academy? To me, that's not clear in this bill. I'd also like to point out that as far as outfitting an officer for the street, very similar to members of your fire departments, it costs quite a bit to outfit an officer to get them ready to go out on the street, and the cost doesn't stop there. On a lot of aspects of what they require for the job, they expire after a certain number of years. A great example of that would be their body armor. So for soft plates, which are your body armor plates that your patrol officers wear on the street, those expire after 5 years. They cost anywhere from $500 to $900 per officer, and departments often save and budget over a long period of time to make sure that they can replace those. Now, if your local government has a SWAT team, for the hard plates for those SWAT team members, those can cost anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 per member of that SWAT team. So you're looking at a very kind of capital intensive turnover period every 5 or so years for those officers. And with this cap, we're very concerned that what it would create is a situation where if the local government hits that cap, they can't adequately and in a timely fashion replace those plates for officers. And if they expire and get into an incident or are shot at, we're very concerned about what that would mean for officer safety. We've also had different departments that have saved up to do staffing studies to make sure that we are keeping, as our departments across the board are keeping, the number of police officers that are patrolling the streets in our local jurisdictions to a commensurate level with the population increases. This would potentially affect that if we have a local government that's saving up over time and, again, hit that threshold. Again, with the training aspect of it, if we have an out-of-state training that often occurs for our officers, so let's say there's a training in Texas on use of force, and we want to send, or a department wants to send, X number of officers to that training. Oftentimes, they'll plan in advance and say, okay, here's our training budget. If they reserve the spots in that training, hit the spending cap, they're not going to be able to send those officers to the training because they're not going to have time to levy those funds, wait for an election, and then eventually send those officers to that training. So we feel that this bill has quite a few issues that cause concern for us, and we would encourage your no vote on the bill.
Any other opponents in the room? And if you could keep it succinct, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Heinbach, H-I-N-E-B-A-U-C-H, and I'm a member of the Great Falls City Commission. And I want to express my opposition to this bill. I'm not really sure what the voter sentiment is in Missoula, but in Great Falls, our voters expect us to be conservative with our budget. In two of the last 5 years, we didn't take the inflationary increase, but I don't feel like we should be punished for what's happening in other cities. So I believe the inflationary increase is a common sense conservative approach for us to increase our budget, and if anything else over and above that, we can send it to the voters. Thank you for your time, and I hope you vote no on this bill.
Thank you. Any other opponents?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adrienne Cotton, C-O-T-T-O-N, here on behalf of AARP Montana. We believe that House Bill 324 hampers the ability of our local governments, whose leaders are empowered by your constituents, and it undermines the fiscal stability of cities and towns. We're concerned about the ability of local government to adopt resources that support our rapidly growing older adult population. Even grants here fall under total overall expenditures. Thank you. We urge you to pass. I'm sorry. I'm used to supporting. We urge you to vote no.
Thank you. Any other opponents?
Madam Chair, I'm Eric Burke on behalf of the Montana Federation of Public Employees. We do represent public employees who are law enforcement, health workers, public service workers in many cities and counties across the state of Montana. I'll be very succinct. You heard from other opponents. Our biggest argument against this is what it does is it places a really arbitrary cap on our local governments. One that is very ill-defined. When you look at population growth and you look at inflation and you average it over 3 years, you're going to have situations that were brought up by Mr. Marsh representing firefighters where you're not able to deal with real inflation. You're not able to deal with the real impacts that cities are dealing with. So that's number one. We also think there's going to be unintended consequences anytime you put an arbitrary cap into a state law and expect that it will just work. There are going to be situations it does not take into account, and I think Mr. Bryson did an excellent job of pointing out all the various components that would need to be defined to avoid unintended consequences. And even then, you're still going to have unintended consequences when you place a state cap like this into law. So for all the reasons you've heard, we oppose the bill and would urge your opposition as well. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Other opponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Davis, D-A-V-I-S. I'm here on behalf of the Missoula Fire Department in opposition to this bill. House Bill 324 will have a negative impact on the Missoula Fire Department and, in turn, the constituents we serve, not only in keeping up with growth, but maintaining our current service level. I am here today to express how House Bill 324 will affect public safety and fire departments. I will keep this brief. I have quite a bit, but I'll shorten that up just for the sake of time. Capital expenses, as you've heard before, for public safety from the Police Association representative and the Fire Association, as our capital expenses for fire apparatus and essential life-saving equipment have increased due to inflation substantially. We're looking at $700,000 for a standard fire engine and about $1.5 million for a ladder truck purchase. And as we've seen with the supply chain due to COVID and other factors, we're looking at 24 months to 36 months before we're taking possession of these newer purchases. So I do have concerns of capital expenses. And as been said before, we don't purchase these annually, but they are on a replacement schedule every 10 to 15 to 20 years, and they are critical to our operation. I fear that this bill could have consequences on unfunded mandates. A recent example would be a change in workers' compensation that our firefighters fought long and hard for that caused an increase in our premium rates, caused MMIA to increase our premium rates to over $200,000 per year. And that was an unfunded mandate that we were unexpected that we had to pay. Grant funding, as we continue to pursue grants to be fiscally responsible, to purchase large capital items, personnel, et cetera, a lot of those grant funding either come with a match of some sort or where the cities have to pick up the funding after the grant has expired. And I am fearful that this bill may have unintended consequences in supporting grant funding. Yes?
Would you please stay on the bill and try not to repeat too much of your testimony?
Yes.
Thank you.
And again, so with that, I just want to say that I am here in opposition to this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard on such an important issue. And this bill can significantly impact all essential services. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Other opponents?
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. Philip Keating, KEATING. I'm here representing the Missoula Fire Department. I just wanted to touch on one thing that I don't think has been covered yet, and that was the population growth calculation. So based on our projections, we were projected based on population to reach 12,000 calls in 2027. And we reached that in over that in 2022. So I think that that's an antiquated measurement to figure based on aging population and the increase in medical calls. So thank you. And like everybody else, I oppose. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Keating. Other opponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Hensley, H-E-N-S as in Sam, L-E-Y, Jennifer is spelled traditionally. I stand before you this afternoon on behalf of the County of Missoula. I echo the previous opponent's remarks when it comes to the workability of the bill. The way it's written, it just it's very confusing to our folks on the ground trying to figure out how they would, in fact, implement this bill. One additional point that the previous folks have made, but I do want to elevate, the counties are not experiencing the surplus that this legislative body is. They have way fewer levers to pull than are available to the state legislature. It's property taxes for where they have the levers to pull. The state, as you know, has income tax, property tax, special revenue, et cetera. So the narrative that I've been hearing over and over about reckless spending, you know, we're at the table, as Ms. Lynch said, to try and explain where our money's going, how it's coming, where it's coming from, in granular detail. I have down to the pencil budget for the County of Missoula, and anybody who'd like to sit down with me, I'm happy to go over that. But the narrative that this expenditure is out of control is just not our reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hensley. Other opponents? No, are there any other opponents? Are there opponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Rich Cowger is online.
Okay. Mr. Cowger, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. My name's Rich Cowger, C-O-W-G-E-R. I'm the fire chief in Columbus, and I also represent the Montana Fire Alliance, which is the State Chiefs Association, the Fire Districts Association, State Volunteers Association, and the County Fire Wardens Association.
And I quickly realized that this bill doesn't affect Stillwater County, but one of the glitches that would come up in this bill is if you look at the 2020 census, it shows us actually losing population, when the reality is that's not the case. You can't find a house or a lot to buy in Stillwater County. So we know that population actually went up, which increases our demand for service. Quick couple calculations over the last 3 years, our utilities, which we have no control over, for our fire district went up 28%. Our fuel costs, which is driven by call response, went up 115%. Those are all things that we have no control over at local government, but yet we have a demand on the service. And I'll keep it brief and ask for do not pass on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cowger. We've reached our half-hour limit. How many more people were here to testify? I think we're pretty close. Are there any more online?
Just an informational witness, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's move to that then. Are there informational witnesses in the room? See none? We'll listen to our informational witness online. Ms. Black. I think you're muted, Ms. Black.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Colleen Black, C-O-L-L-E-E-N-B-L-A-C-K. And I'm a CPA in Billings, and I read the article that was in the Billings Gazette locally the other day. And I feel like I have a unique position in Billings, given that I see lots of different households of taxpayers in the state of Montana, from very poor to quite wealthy. And so I just wanted to offer my...
Mr. Chair, point of order. Is she an informational witness or is she giving testimony? Aren't we supposed to ask her?
Informational witnesses generally just give their name and then stand by for questions. Let us know who you're with.
I apologize. I'll be an informational witness, and if you have questions, you can ask me.
Okay, and you can tell who you're with. I see your...
Actually... I'm a CPA in Billings. I am not representing Montana Society of CPAs. I'm representing myself, and I own a small business, a CPA firm.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Black.
Certainly.
Seeing no more informational witnesses, are there questions from the committee? Representative Konauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Mr. Bryson, if I might.
Mr. Bryson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Konauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bryson, after hearing your testimony, I just have one fairly simple question.
Good.
It seems to me that the way the construction of this bill would be is that you would have to go to the voters to get a mill levy passed or a bond passed, and then when you expended or were ready to actually spend the money on the project and you exceeded your spending cap, you'd have to go back to the voters again. Is that so?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conner, let's talk Lewis and Clark County because you're familiar with that. Bond levy, bond measure, both an operational levy for a limited duration, 10 years to renovate the, or to operate the renovated detention center, and a bond measure to service the debt for the renovation of the detention center that was just servicing the debt for the life of that loan. Both of those were adopted by the voters in a certain year, but they were phased in because the county didn't need all the money in the first year for the renovation, nor did they need it in the first 3 years for operations. By year four, year-over-year changes very likely would have triggered a requirement to submit to the voters a question to spend the money that the voters authorized in the debt service levy and the operational levy, given the mechanics of this bill. A real-world example of exactly what you're saying, yes, the way I understand the bill.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Representative Gunderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ramos, Mr. Bryson spoke of a timeline. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the question.
Please.
Oh, to you?
Yeah. You say Mr. Chair.
Oh,
and then
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gunderson.
Representative Gunderson. I'm getting flashbacks of city council up here. So frazzled. But that's a great question, Mr. Chair and Representative Gunderson. So the timeline on it is actually very simple. We don't want to have to do what the Tabor bill in Colorado does, where you have to refund certain things. All it is that these... And I'm sure there's going to be other questions about it. It's hard not to dive down all the past that we heard today from opposition. But simply, the cities are going to adopt their budget at the end of August of a current year. There's an election every November that they could use, or they could hold a special election, however they see fit. And then when they adopt their budget, it just has to be at that rate of population plus inflation. Again, that is a very generous cap. That we're doing, as the current cap on mill levies is half the rate of inflation. So if mill levies were all it was, then, I mean, there shouldn't be an issue here. But in any event, so they vote on it in November, and then if it passes, then in the next budget cycle, they will be able to use those funds that was approved by the voters in addition to that current year's population plus inflation cap. So really simple. We want to make it simple. We don't want to make it complicated. We want voters to be able to understand it.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Ramos, I heard a lot of the firefighters talking about how it would impact them. So how will this impact EMS and let's just throw school buses in there at the same time?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson, I think that's a really good question, and certainly I think it's a big concern to folks. When I was on city council for 4 years, I didn't vote against a single increase to police, fire, emergency services of any kind, and this bill would not touch that. It would force the cities to, sure, prioritize the police, the fire, the infrastructure, but that is an issue that the cities and the fire department should be taking up with the city commissions. This would not in any way impact them unless the city was building heated bridges and other things that maybe they shouldn't be doing. So absolutely not. It forces cities to prioritize emergency services, and I think that they should fully be funded, and this bill allows for that plus some.
Okay, and then one more follow-up.
One more.
How's this going to impact property taxes?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson. So this is going to impact property taxes in one of two ways. So as we've heard about rebates and all these complicated things about special districts and special assessments and all these very, very complicated and complex ideas that the voters could never understand, the cities are simply going to have to decide. So if their budget comes in above population plus inflation, whether it's in a fee, a surcharge, any number of things, they have the ability, I know it hasn't happened in a long time, but they do have the ability to lower taxes. They can lower the mills levied. They can lower the percentage that they're charging in fines, fees, surcharges, permits. They can lower, again, the special assessments, the special districts, so they can lower all of that. So it's not going to, there's ways, and we trust the cities as entrepreneurs to be able to figure out how to best do this with the lowest impacts to their citizens. So it impacts property taxes, however the cities see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Flexible.
Representative Thane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions for Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ramos, you included in your packet, and you've referenced a couple times, Missoula's spending spree, and I'd like to take a look at that list briefly.
Yeah.
I noticed there are about 9 items and probably a lot more that are actually accomplished through tax increment financing. So the way that works, Mr. Ramos, is my understanding that the property tax level is determined prior to the improvements. That amount of taxing authority still remains with city government. But once the improvement is made, the enhanced taxable value goes to repay the tax increment financing. So I'll pick one of the projects. You referenced a $7 million incentive to the mall. Was that not, in fact, largely to extend Mary Avenue to create a new connector street from Reserve Street to Brooks, as opposed to enhancing Southgate Mall? Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thane, I appreciate the question. I love talking about TIF. I don't want to spoil too much because I think we have another bill coming up about that. But so talking about TIF, I do have to get a little bit into the weeds because it is complicated. Essentially what happens is there's a specific geographic area. You freeze the tax base in that specific geographic area, and all the growth within that district from that point of freezing on goes to the Missoula Redevelopment Agency and Urban Renewal District, any number of things, and then that money is spent on a variety of things. So directly to the Southgate Mall, I'm so glad that you brought it up, actually. So the Southgate Mall, in their proposal to us, they specifically said they'd already made $16 million of improvements of private money to the Southgate Mall. Then they came to Missoula and said that, the city of Missoula, that if they didn't get a private road on their private property that would specifically help them get Lucky's Market into the shopping center, then the mall was going to go out of business. It was going to be future blight. The sky was going to fall. It was going to be terrible. So what we ended up doing is we gave them $7 million to help with the private road on their private property to help them get in an additional tenant in Lucky's Market, which closed 2 years later, by the way, which is unfortunate. So we gave them $7 million, and that was actually only the principal. So when you include the interest on that, total cost the taxpayer is about $12 million. And about a year after we gave them that, I'll get back to that. So a year after we granted them that money for that improvement, they sold the mall to an out-of-state company for $54 million. And because of the way the incentive worked, after they sold the mall, we then reimbursed them for the work on the road on their private property, the $7.5 million. So after they sold it out-of-state for $54 million, we gave them $7.5 million in an incentive for their road. And then after that, Lucky's Market closed, and it's still not really doing anything. So I'm glad you brought up Southgate Mall.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So, clarification. Did this tax increment financing result in a new connector street between Reserve Street and Brooks Avenue?
On the mall's private property that has a bunch of roundabouts designed specifically to slow down traffic and design them and designate them to different stores in the shopping center.
But there is a new through street, correct, Mr. Chair? Mr. Ramos?
Mr. Ramos, it's
yes.
Kind of a yes or no answer. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Zolnikoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Ramos, please.
Mr. Ramos.
It's a marathon.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ramos, I was wondering if you could tell me roughly what percentage of city's budgeted expenditures are from non-property taxes?
That is a great question, and I'm really glad that
you... Chair, please.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Zolnikoff, thank you very much for the question. So I just wanted to... That is a great question. So in Missoula last year, and I'm talking about Missoula only because that's where I'm an expert. That's where I served 4 years on. This is happening all across the state and in a few major cities. But in any event, so in Missoula, our budget expenditures in fiscal year 2022 were $187 million. Of that, actually assessed property taxes through the mill system was about $29 million. So about 16% of our total budgeted expenditures were just from mill taxes. So that is why this bill is so critical, is because it addresses the additional 84% of city spending that has been created as a form of cap management to get around that cap levy, that levy cap.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a different question, not necessarily a follow up to that one. And you can re-refer if you need to, but I'm looking at this sheet that I guess I realized you didn't pass out, but looking at, you know, let's say Great Falls, for example, their budget growth is at 7.8%, but the spending increase over population and inflation is at negative 27.6%. So I'm just wondering, can you, I guess, help me kind of understand the discrepancy between those numbers?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, Representative Zolnikoff, thank you for the follow-up. So as you can see, you've brought up a great example. So with Great Falls, they have a really good budget. They have a conservative budget. They spend on essentials. They spend on needs, not wants, it seems. And so cities like them, they're not going to be impacted by this bill at all. So that is a great example of a major city doing the right thing. And this bill is, again, not going to punish them. It's not punishing anybody. It's asking the voters to approve spending. But somewhere like Great Falls is a great example of somebody that's doing it right, and they're not going to even know this bill got passed.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair, one more follow-up.
Okay, one more.
One more, I promise. Okay, so just to follow up really quickly, so we heard a lot in the opponent testimony about, you know, water treatment plants and firefighters and all that stuff, but kind of looking at this information and looking at this sheet specifically with the park districts and the road districts, are the funding for those specific services, are they from these districts that have grown, you know, 3,500%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zolnikoff, would you mind restating the question? Sorry.
Yes, sorry, Mr. Chair. I guess one more. So in opponent testimony, we heard, you know, examples of water treatment plants and fire departments. So my question is, like, per this handout, are the budgets for those municipal services, are they coming from these park districts and road districts that are increasing so much?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zolnikoff, great question. They are not. In Missoula's case, we did try to pass one of these special districts, and that there was enough protest that that didn't happen. So no, that is not coming from that. And enterprise funds like water, wastewater, I believe in the amendment, or there will be an amendment that excludes those because those are essentially a business.
Thank you.
Representative Sinkins-Crow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Ramos, please. Just looking back at this wonderful little graph so that I know I can understand things, but just want to ask you a question about this. How would these special districts be affected by this limitations on spending?
So that is, the, Mr. Chair, Representative Sinkins-Crow, thank you so much for the question. So the question, the answer to that question is however the city deem fit. So if they are, if they want to continue to grow these special districts by 318% per year, they can do that, but they're going to have to reduce the mills levied, or they're going to have to reduce the building permit fees, or they're going to have to reduce the chicken licenses or something like that. One of the thing, one of their thousands of revenue sources they're going to have to reduce. So it will impact it in the sense that it'll control the growth. So these districts were set up specifically to manage the cap to get around it. So that's why you've been seeing so much growth. My guess would be that they're going to lower the mills levied, or they could simply, an easy fix would be to lower how much they're assessing from these down to maybe a normal, I don't know, 20% annual increase.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Rexon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Ramos. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ramos, could you compare what Mr. Grison said with your testimony in terms of changes to the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rexton, I got it that time. I really appreciate the question. So I just wanted to, so on that, as I said, I spoke to Mr. Bryson before, and we had a great conversation about some amendments that I think are common sense. The Enterprise Fund was one of them, and I think that is fine. That was an oversight that didn't get into the bill, I believe. So that is more than reasonable. I guess what was interesting is that he laid out some common sense amendments and then said that the bill could never work at the end. So that's what really confused me. It can definitely work. So the common sense amendments, I'm happy to work with him on those and happy to talk to him and see if those would fit for the voters and then give him that feedback. But at the end of the day, I would say most of the amendments were very reasonable. I can't remember them all because, I can't. But one of them, I think it addressed the fact that there's voter-approved mills already and bonds. If those have already been approved by the voters, those are good. We just want one vote on these for both the passing and the expenditure of those. So if that isn't clear in the bill and can be addressed, I think that is more than a reasonable amendment. So I think I don't think I'm doing a great job answering. I apologize.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ramos, I'm going to give you an example. Great Falls has over 58 separate funds, and the general fund is just the one that collects property taxes. It's already capped. So if this is violated, who's the policeman? Where's the penalty? Where's the hammer?
Representative, or Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, I don't know the answer to that question.
So another thing to think about. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Follow up. Why would this only pertain to larger communities? We had testimony questioning that. It seemed like it's only penalizing the larger cities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, I don't know the specific answer to that question. I wouldn't have any problem with this bill. I didn't write the bill. I have no problem with it.
Redirect to the sponsor.
Redirect to the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, one of the reasons we went for that approach is because we really did not see the data that a lot of these rural counties and cities were having a spending problem. As was stated before, if your city and county has been fiscally conservative, not wasting your tax dollars, this is going to be a nothing burger bill for you. So it's pretty much tailored to rein in those that are spending too much.
Follow up. But are you certain you went through the ins and outs of the dynamics of running a city and a county with all the different counts and revenue streams and things to see that, I guess I'd like you to comment on, we have an example of Great Falls that's running really, really well. So obviously the system's workable. Isn't it a local issue?
A local issue, as in a local control issue in terms of the spending, Mr.
Correct.
Chair?
Correct. I mean, it just seems that, Mr. Chair.
Chair.
Representative, it just seems to be an issue in certain committees, which we hear a lot in this committee, of issues that some areas are struggling and others aren't. And frankly,
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, I feel that how much property taxes and just taxes in general has risen recently and so rapidly across Montana, this has become a statewide issue. And honestly, in terms of local control in the Montana Constitution, Article 11, which is local government, Section 3, which reforms the government, says the legislature shall provide methods for governing local government units. This is completely constitutional, and I think it's a statewide issue at this point, Representative.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? I actually have a couple for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Representative. In the last session, we actually capped the increases on special districts, that they have to be voted on already to expand them. And I'm going to try and throw two in at once on the special, on the enterprise funds. Are you saying you're amenable to an amendment to amend out the enterprise funds? And are you amenable to a amendment out on the special districts because they're already capped?
I'm amenable. Those would both be friendly, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right. Would you like to close on your bill, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. A lot of MACO's funding concerns can be resolved by lowering the mills and lowering the fines, fees, and surcharges. On the argument of why not apply this cap to the state, I'd be happy to when the time comes. Also, tax cuts are currently only a tax shift, as local governments are on spending excessively and not reducing spending. So what we have here is a choice. Who do we answer to? Our local government officials or to our constituents? The constituents who are and will continue to get the raw end of the deal on property taxes, arbitrary fees, fines, and mills, and much more, all in the name of unchecked and unregulated spending. It is fair to say that most cities and counties are not spending like drunken sailors, but some cities are spending like drunken navies. We will never fix expanding local government and rising costs that comes with it unless we fix the root of the problem, the spending. I want cities and counties to prioritize fire departments, police, roads, essential needs, not waste like swimming pools, multicolored sidewalks, bridges to nowhere, and handouts to big businesses. And it seems to me that some, but not all, cities and counties have developed a literal spending addiction, an entitlement attitude attitude that the property tax dollars of the citizenry are theirs by right. Let's cap the spending addiction. I believe that this is, I believe the future of a livable Montana is at stake here. Let's do what's right for our constituents. The taxpayers vote green light on House Bill 324.
Thank you, Representative. With that, this ends the public hearing on House Bill 324. We'll take just a moment to allow the room to clear, and then we'll begin our next hearing. Open the public hearing on House Bill 360. Representative Galloway, would you like to present your bill? As soon as you fix the podium.
Yeah, I give up.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman Brewster and good committee of local government. I am Representative Stephen Galloway. I hail from the great city of Great Falls. I represent House District 24, and you can spell my last name G-A-L-L-O-W-A-Y. And I feel it a privilege to serve my constituents there. I bring to you today a really complicated bill. We're going to be here for a long time. So if you just look at page one, we are just creating an opportunity for counties. So as you know, county commissioners run in two-year cycles, you know, two and two and two, kind of similar to senators so that they're rotating. And it's required by state law or current statute that you live in the district you're going to represent. So typically, and this isn't all counties, but this is the most typical setting, is that there's three of them. And currently, you have to live in the district, but you get elected by the whole county. We're making a simple change to current statute in 73412, and we're changing the word shall to must, and that's the first three. You have to do the first three. Number one, at large, and I'm not going to read all that, you can read it. What the bill recently does is or number four. Number four is elected by district in which candidates must reside and which are apportioned by population. So what that simply means is instead of being elected by the whole county, they're only going to be elected by the constituents in their district. And that's the whole bill in a nutshell, and I will sit for opponents and proponents and informational witnesses and all that long stuff and reserve the right to close.
All right, thank you, Representative Galloway. Are there opponents or proponents in the room? Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bryson. That's B-R-Y-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties. I am a proponent of this bill, and I'm going to make it short and sweet. The sponsor did a great job.
It's as confusing as you want to get in question and answer, so don't ask me any questions and we won't make it confusing. The standard form of government for counties, if they did nothing else, is the elected county official form, ECOF. It has a general reference in Title VII. No other place is it defined. The elected county official form of government takes parts and pieces of all the other plans and says what you can do. That's not what this is. This is the commission form of government, which is sometimes confused with the elected county official. This is an adopted alternative form of government. What the sponsor wanted is for the citizens to be able to evaluate their form and plan and choose an option that said, we want our commissioners to live in their district, be roughly apportioned, and then be elected by the district rather than at large. He accomplishes that task with this bill. We support the bill because this is a choice. It clarifies an adopted alternative form, which would be the commission, that a commissioner can be elected from his district rather than at large. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but pass this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson. Are there other proponents in the room? Seeing none, are there proponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Are there opponents in the room? Seeing none, are there opponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Are there informational witnesses in the room? Are there informational witnesses online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Are there questions from the committee? Representative Thain.
Question for the sponsor, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thain.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, would this require each county to develop an apportionment commission, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this would only come into trigger if they decided they wanted to adopt this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So who would decide these districts and how the population is apportioned, and would it have to be reviewed on a somewhat regular basis, Mr. Chair?
I would probably re-refer that if you would like.
Mr. Bryson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thain, to your first question, county commission districts under the elected county official form are apportioned roughly in equal size in population and in geography. That's done on a 10-year process, and that final result of the commissioners trying to draw boundaries that take that into consideration is submitted to a district court judge for review and approval. Under this form, same apportionment process would work. They would be drawn by Board of County Commissioners who frankly let their GIS folks do it, submitted to a district judge who would then recognize that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Essman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Essman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Galloway, Mr. Sponsor, could you explain to me the difference between number 2 and number 4, except for that there is an S in districts in number 4?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Representative, it's the first 3 combined. You have to do all 3 of those. So you have to do number 1, you have to do number 2, and you have to do number 3. Or you can opt in to going to number 4, which is the simpler here. And part of the reason is think about this. You may open the door to have more commissioners throw their hat in the ring because they only have to run in that population. It's not going to be near as expensive. There's just different pluses to it. Does that make sense? Don't you do the first 3 or the 4th one?
Mr. Chairman, follow up?
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, good sponsor. Why would anybody do the 3 then? Instead of just the 1.
Mr. Chair, Representative Essman, that is what they currently do. I'm trying to open the door in our state so that they could choose to do this. Number 4.
Thank you. I think I finally get it. Thank you.
Right. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Corda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the sponsor, please. Mr. Chair, Representative, who in the county decides if this format is taken? Is that the county commissioners or the voters?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cordham, if you read, the commission must be, so the commissioners are going to make that decision. Now, if you don't like the way it's being done as a constituent, I'm sure you can look for a candidate that supports this and encourage them to run to adopt this. So it gives the populace a chance to change the form if they don't like the way it's working, if they don't feel they're being represented in the way they're being elected by the whole populace. You look at how you ran in your county, but you were only elected by your district. This would be a similar comparison.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, I'm envisioning an election in which only a third of the citizens of the county get to vote. And in that election, it's very close. It's about 50-50. That means 16.5% of the residents would elect a representative for 100% of the county. And that leaves about 83.5% of the county with a commissioner that they might not want or that they don't want. That seems like a lot of power in very few hands, and I'm a little bit worried that'll be very unbalanced for everybody else.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's why it's just an option. It's not a must. If you don't want it in your county, then don't adopt it.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair?
One more.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what's to stop the commissioners in power for implementing this system and then just using it to ensure lifelong power?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's why people have a vote. If they don't like what these guys are doing, then you vote them out. And it'd be much easier on a smaller level than to try to convince the whole populace that you don't like this guy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Other questions? I think nobody. Did you have a question? Okay. Representative Gunderson.
Mr. Chair, for the sponsor. Mr. Chair, I think I know where Representative Cordham's kind of going sideways on this. Lincoln County's broken up into three separate equal districts. We have a commissioner that is responsible and oversees that district, and then District 2, District 3. When they're elected, they are elected by all of the people in the county, correct? So what this is doing is it's going to have District 1 have somebody or candidates, plural, run for that district. 2 is going to have its own candidates and elect its own district, correct?
You're partially correct. Mr. Chair, I'd like to clarify that because they're going to rotate just like senators. You have your holdover senator. All three of them aren't elected on the same cycle. So you have
Mr. Chair.
One running for 2 years, one running for 2 years, one running for 2 years. So you're only going to have an election in that one district every 3 years.
Right. And follow up?
Follow up.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, so that means that only the people that are in that living in that district where the candidate lives are going to elect that candidate or candidates.
Correct.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? I have one, if you don't mind.
For Mr. Chair.
When you say 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, you're actually saying 6-year term staggered every 2 years.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. All right. No other questions? Would you like to close in your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the good questions. I think it's just it's just another opportunity for local governments to have an option if they feel that the system that we're currently under doesn't work for it. I just briefly share you some national. Good government groups have supported single-member districts and local bodies such as county commissioners for many years. In this system, each county is divided into several equal population districts, each with one commissioner who is elected by the voters in that district. The variation on the system add, and this we're not doing, so I should skip that. Single member districts allow for better representation of the different groups in the county and ensure that the major groups within the electorate have a strong voice on the council. So what they're saying there is oftentimes when you're elected by the whole body, this other area that isn't even in your district that you represent may have an influence on who's elected over there. This gives you a more direct line to who's representing your district. This is especially important where groups with varying interests are geographically concentrated in particular parts of a county. So I think this is often where you have the difference in some counties where one district may be a lot more rural and only have a little bit of the city in it, possibly. This is one. And you could see where the other districts that are heavy urban, they may have a flavor to pick somebody who's going to favor only the urban. This gives you a chance to have better representation for the people who actually live in your district. When all the county commissioners are elected at large, everyone votes for all of them. It's easy for the largest group to win, or at least most of the seats. A dominant group may be defined by party and many other things. Income at large systems enable dominant groups to limit the ability of people in the other groups to have their voices heard on the commission. With that, I would ask for a due pass on House Bill 360.
Thank you, Representative Galloway. With that, we close the hearing on House Bill 360. We'll just wait a minute or two and we'll head into the next one. All right, with that, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 369. Representative, would you like to open on your bill?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Marty Malone, M-A-L-O-N-E. I represent District 59, which includes rural Park County, Sweetgrass County, and a small portion of Gallatin. Today I bring you House Bill 369. Basically, the bill requires local governments to submit a growth policy plan to the electorate before for approval. Notice of on line 15 that when I started out that we just changed may to shall, and down below there were some other things that legal said I had to put in there. But right now, currently commissions select a firm to write the growth policy. They could select a firm that fits their political agenda, if you want to say that. County planners work with the planning board and the contractor to write the plan, and then the plan can be legally adopted by as few as two elected officials. Commissioners then can take an action restricting building, setbacks, zoning, based on the language in the growth policy that they say was approved by the people. On the other hand, if the people don't like that plan, they're dissatisfied with that decision to adopt that growth policy, current law requires an election to repeal the plan. I think that's wrong. My proposal would require a vote by the impacted citizenry of the county. Local government officials need to sell that proposed policy to the people and ensure that that policy meets the needs and desires of the electorate. I will listen to proponents and opponents and reserve the right to close. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Malone. Are there proponents in the room? Any proponents?
Ann Hollowell, A-N-N-H-A-L-L-O-W-E-L-L. I'm representing myself.
Go ahead.
Chairman Brewster and committee members, the requirements for a growth policy have grown and grown over the years. This added complication has compelled cities and counties to use community development block grants to hire out-of-area and often out-of-state consultants to write these reports. What we end up with is precisely what the Montana Growth Policy Resource Book warns against, a complicated tomb collecting dust on the shelf. What the people get is a rambling report of out-of-area opinions interspersed with facts justifying the consultant's billable hours rather than a local vision and an achievable plan. Many residents, due to work constraints, cannot go to the scheduled public meetings to give feedback? Is the out-of-town, out-of-state consultants' growth policy your vision for your family and county? Is it the future you want, or have the nonprofits and special interests drown you out? A referendum, the ability to vote up or down for the adoption, revision, or rejection of a growth policy is the only real way citizens can have a respected voice in the matter. Your voice, your vote. A vote relieves us of the unpleasant conflict of interest when a commissioner votes for his own project. A vote protects residents from unvetted amendments crafted by special interest groups, not citizens. When we are allowed to vote, we are more comfortable and vested in the outcome, whatever that may be. Give people a voice in their future. Give us a growth policy by referendum. Support HB 369. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there other proponents in the room?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jeff Wagner. That's J-E-F-F-W-A-G-N-E-R, and I'm a citizen of Park County. And I'm here to strongly encourage you to support HB 369. It's an important, necessary check to place on local governing bodies to ensure the policies they seek to adopt are consistent with what the wants and needs of the impacted constituents are. Right now, there's a public process, but the public process isn't really a dialogue. It's sort of a half-duplex conversation. As a citizen, you can go offer your public comment, so you're talking on the phone and you're talking, but you're not getting any response back from anybody. Nobody's saying anything back to you. You're just offering your comment. And having been involved in a couple issues, land use issues in Park County, where the public process was used, the public comment, both written, documented, written and verbal comment, was opposed to the measure that was being considered, yet in both cases, the commission voted to approve it. So of the three commissioners, they just need two to vote. And as Representative Malone pointed out, the pushback is extremely onerous. In fact, I was part of a process where we tried to seek to repeal the growth policy in Park County. And what that required was that we had to first gather 20% of the signatures of the impacted voters, so that's 1,900 signatures. And that gets you to put it on a referendum that goes go to a vote where a majority of the voters in the county have to approve it, so that's about, in Park County's population, we'd be about 6,000 or 7,000 folks have to vote for it. So we were running this process right at the height of COVID, and so when people were conditioned to stay away from strangers, we were able to collect 1,300 signatures of the 1,900 we needed. I have no doubt we would have gotten well above the 1,900 had people not been running away from us rather than walking up to our table to talk to us. So it's very difficult to push back there, and it puts a load on the back end of the process. This proposal would put the load on the front end of it. So rather than wait until after something happens and you try and repeal it, you go to the citizens initially and say, does this meet your needs, your desires for the growth policy you want to have? And as Ann and Mario pointed out, that the current policy is too subject to the biases of those who are generating the policy. So whether that's the county planning staff or special interest groups, they're professional organizations. They have people that are paid to impact the process. And as a citizen, you're having to carve time out of your own schedule to go and pay attention to what's going on and try and provide some comment that you don't know how much weight is going to be given to it. And it's just very difficult to push back against that large force of special interest and the county administrative staff if they're trying to push things in a certain direction. And as I was collecting these signatures, what became abundantly clear was that people were really shocked to find out that the growth policy was voted on and implemented without really any say from them, other than perhaps maybe speaking in some public forum. They people, almost to a person, said that is not right that a policy like this is implemented and I don't have a formal say in its adoption. And that was whether they agreed with our notion to repeal the policy or not. Just in general, they thought that policies of such importance, they should have a vote in as citizens of the county. And by requiring the process, the front end of it is loaded as it goes to a vote, that places the burden on the local governing body to provide the rationale and justification for that policy. If they're confident in their policy, they should have no problem pushing public opinion in that direction. So in short, the best way to ensure you have the consent of the folks that you're governing is to put the measure to a vote to the qualified electors. And this measure is not about providing opportunity for more public involvement. It's really all about enabling public involvement where it matters most, and that's in having a final say in the decision that's being made for the policy that they're looking to adopt. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Are there other proponents in the room?
Chair Brewster, committee members, Gwen O'Hare, GWENO'HAIR, and I'm here in support of it, of this bill. We're ranchers, and growth policies impact the land use, the distribution of population, et cetera. And in our particular county, which I'm also from Park County, we have seen the disregard, I believe, for private property rights and just for the general respect of people's property. And you all represent us. You're from all over the state of Montana. And a policy that protects the people and gives them a voice to articulate what they want and how they want to be governed, how they want their land used, et cetera. And I'm not against policies that help control growth or whatever, but I think it should be put to a vote of the citizens of that particular county, wherever it is within the state. And I'm fully supporting this bill because too much power, too much control, too much, et cetera, I could go into the money, et cetera, has changed hands, and too many special interests. And it's like was mentioned earlier, there are a lot of special interest groups. They have time. There are a lot of members of my particular family that would like to be here today to speak to you all and to share their opinions. They're home calving. They're home doing their job. They're home doing things that does not allow them to take off and to petition county commissioners, et cetera, on behalf of a particular pursuit or a particular interest. And a growth policy is a form of zoning, it is a form of control, etc. And the people should have an opportunity to resist that or approve it, accept it. Certain counties may want it, others may not. But it should be up to the citizens and not up to people who have the time, the money, and the energy. We don't get paid to go to meetings. We have to earn a living. So I am totally in support of it. I concur with what's been said, and you'll probably hear some people who are opponents of it, and I hope you take into consideration whose ox is getting gored. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Hare. Are there other proponents in the room? Seeing none, are there proponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Are there opponents in the room?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kelly Lynch, LYNCH, Executive Director of the Montana League of Cities and Towns. I'll be brief. This bill takes us in exactly the opposite direction that we need to go with our land use and planning laws. I've got four specific reasons. First, most local governments, if you want to get a grant, any kind of federal grant, and even some state grants, you have to have a growth policy. So we would immediately be ineligible for those grants. Second, they're not regulatory. It is the first step in making decisions about doing regulations, but the growth policy itself is not regulatory. Third, with this bill, every permit that would come through the process for either zoning approval or subdivision approval would have to go through the whole public process from that point, and you would have to get the growth policy to a vote because it has to be in substantial compliance with the growth policy. So if you didn't have a growth policy, you wouldn't be able to get that application through. Fourth, this will put even more of the analysis, the mitigation, the public participation that we've talked about here at the case-by-case basis for each application that comes in. So instead of doing that work up front on the backs of a local government, you will be doing it case-by-case basis on the backs of the developer who's bringing in the application. It's going to further slow down the process. It's going to make that process more costly. It goes against everything that we've been talking about here in this committee. We ask for a do not pass. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Other opponents?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Sam Sill. That's S-I-L-L here on behalf of the Montana Association of Realtors, and I'm actually happy this time to be able to say that I agree with everything that I'm representative of the League of Cities and Towns had to say, which doesn't happen all that often down here. So, I do want to also mention for the record, Mr. Chairman and committee, that the Montana Building Industry Association is also in opposition to this bill, but the representative wasn't able to be here today. Here's the deal from our perspective. This is bad for housing. It's going to be bad for development. It's certainly going to not going to help with some of the strategies this committee has been, other committees have been talking about in terms of improving affordability of housing. As the previous opponent mentioned, as a private property owner, if I want to potentially build some more housing, and maybe I want to build some housing that's more dense than what the current zoning allows, so I need to go in and get a zoning amendment made. If I want to be able to have that zoning amendment be in substantial compliance with the growth policy, which you do, because if you don't, it's going to be an easy target for a legal challenge, you need to come in and get a growth policy amendment. If this bill passes, the voters are going to have to weigh in on that. When's that election going to be? If I come in January and I need a growth policy amendment, am I going to have to wait till the next school election in May? The primary in June, a general election? We don't know. It doesn't say, but regardless, it's going to add a significant amount of time and uncertainty to the development. Something else you all should think about is this committee in 2021 passed an expedited subdivision review bill, and then just a couple weeks ago, the good chairman ran a bill that makes some positive changes, we think, to the expedited review process for subdivisions. In order to qualify for that expedited review, there needs to be a growth policy and there needs to be zoning in place. This bill could potentially, to the extent that a jurisdiction decides they no longer want a growth policy, do away with that, which that's not good either. I think I'll just leave it at that for now. But one thing we should be very cautious of is that while on its face, or superficially, we might like to think that this bill is in some way, good for private property rights. Ultimately, what's going to happen is we'll go back to the what we have in the counties that are unzoned, which is, as a developer, as someone who's going to build the housing that we sorely lack and need, everything will come down to subdivision review. And as the applicant, you won't know basically until you go in front of the governing body after you've done groundwater monitoring and spent all kinds of money on consultants and studies and various analyses whether the development's going to fly or not. You have no certainty or predictability whatsoever. And I would really hate to see, that sort of issues spread into our cities, into our counties that have adopted some level of zoning. So we'd ask for no vote.
Thank you, Mr. Sill. Next opponent.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jennifer Hensley, H-E-N-S-S-N, Sam, L-E-Y. I stand before you on behalf of the County of Missoula. I think we all can agree that two of the biggest priorities of this session thus far have been cutting red tape and addressing our housing situation. With respect to the sponsor, we believe that this goes in the opposite direction. Missoula County partners with private landowners and developers to build public infrastructure. The growth policy is central to their efforts to increase the housing supply and economic opportunity in the community because it articulates a clear path for both the private and the public sectors to where they can build the infrastructure together. Importantly, the best laid plans sometimes need tweaking, and that's why there's a mechanism, a very clear mechanism in place to amend those plans. Requiring a countywide election to adopt, amend, or update a growth policy will add significant cost to projects. We just heard another bill addressing what some perceive to be as too high of a spend on the county level, and this will add hundreds of thousands of dollars in project costs and voter education. The costs will either be passed on to the taxpayer or to the homeowner and renters. Missoula County just finished a 2019 growth policy. It took over 2 years long. They held hundreds of stakeholder meetings with residents and developers. They collected over 3,000 comments from the public. There was always more than enough opportunity for community members who wish to be involved to be involved. That is, inviting them in rather than simply putting out a welcome mat. In 21, Missoula County adopted an amendment to the growth policy for the Mullen area west of the city of Missoula that brought in $13 million in infrastructure funding from the federal government to allow for 6,000 new front doors. We would have not received the grant without the growth policy. In fact, Missoula County is just now kicking off another project called for in the Growth Policy Project, which will extend infrastructure to the Y area, which is an underserved area of the county, increasing the industrial land use base and providing housing supply for the future. If this bill passes, it will signal that the area is a major risk for the development community by creating extraordinary uncertainty in the process and would put a complete stop to developer-proposed growth policy amendments. Growth policies are critically important tools in addressing our housing crisis by creating red tape and bureaucracy, which this bill, respectfully, we believe does. It impedes the development of homes and businesses. We urge a table on this, and I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hensley. Are there other opponents in the room?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. After five, so I'll keep it super short. My name is Jake Brown, B-R-O-W-N, here today with Shelter Whitefish Nonprofit with the mission of advocating for solutions to Montana's affordable housing crisis. And we, too, rise in opposition to House Bill 369. If a local governing body wants to do the right thing and make changes to their growth plan to allow for more dense or more compact, accessible housing, this bill is just going to make that harder. Asking the voters to approve every growth plan, every change, it's just going to make it harder to build housing, but especially the kind of housing that is the most accessible for Montanans. In closing, we're in a housing crisis. If anything, it should be easier to make changes to growth plans so communities can make the changes that they need to do to accommodate for the unprecedented growth that we're seeing across the state. We would urge a do not pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other opponents.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robin Turner, R-O-B-I-N-T-U-R-N-E-R. I'm here on behalf of the city of Whitefish, and we rise in opposition to House Bill 369. So briefly, given that cities provide opportunities for comment when adopting a growth policy or an amendment, doesn't seem practical or helpful to delay the process with a required vote of the electorate when it adds additional costs, as you've heard earlier. I just want to speak to a few things in the City of Whitefish's process so that you can understand the community effort that's come with their growth policies. In 2017, that's the last time that the growth policy was accepted, they had 30 public outreach meetings, visioning and steering committee meetings, and additional planning and planning department and city council meetings. There was then an amendment needed in 2021 on the Highway 93 South Corridor Plan. Public open houses, public visioning sessions, 27 steering community meetings, open work sessions with the city council and planning board. There is another growth plan that is being proposed for the city of Whitefish that's currently in draft, and the city envisions spending the next 24 months, again, with public meetings, visioning opportunities, work sessions, again, the same sort of access to local government and to decision makers for the community. I encourage you to look at the City of Whitefish's website. You can see all of the growth policies that the city's put out, and you can see the number of meetings that were held, and also the group of folks who came together to discuss this from a lot of different perspectives. I think that these policies allow cities to look at the big picture with their constituents and their communities rather than take these on a piecemeal basis, as other opponents have spoken to. And the city welcomes the investment in these conversations and hopes that you will welcome that investment as well and oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Are there other opponents? Could you please be brief? I'd like to save some time for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those are my remarks. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Turquiz, T-U-R-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z. I represent the City of Billings. I think for the many reasons you've heard from testimony from the opponents here today, as well as the issues many of you faced in this committee and other committees, that a growth policy is a key element to survival, growth, and meeting the needs of their community. This makes it harder, more time-consuming, and does not allow local governments to respond to those needs. We urge a do not pass. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other opponents?
Chairman, members of the committee, Sam Forstag, F-O-R-S-T-A-G, here on behalf of the cities of Missoula and Bozeman. In the interest of brevity, and because you've heard most of these points made already, we urge you to vote no on this bill. This would simply make us less responsive in the face of unprecedented growth in both of our cities. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you very much for your brevity. Other opponents in the room? Are there opponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Hagemeyer, H-A-G-E-M-E-I-E-R. And today I'm representing the Montana Association of Planners. I sit on the board of directors, the legislative committee, and I've actually written a lot of growth policies here in Montana. I'm going to skip most of my testimony because you've already heard it from everybody else, but I do just want to give a story about a situation right now in my current job where this bill will actually have a really detrimental impact on the private development community and providing housing in our state. It's really common for developers to request growth policy amendments, especially when they're looking for higher densities or change in use. I happen to be processing one right now. It's in Lolo, Montana. The school district sold their school to a developer to get money to build a new school. And that growth policy designation, because it's been a school for 100 years, is public. So it has to change for the developer to be able to develop their property. And they've gone through an outreach process with the community and they're now coming forward with a proposal that will create about 150 units and some potential commercial space. If this bill were to pass, then they would have to wait to the next election cycle to move forward with their project. And they also would be taking a lot of risk because they would have the whole county vote on their development project. And I think we all agree that it's not a good idea for everyone to be voting on private development projects. So this bill will introduce a lot of uncertainty to private developers. And I think, in my opinion, it would be killing a lot of projects that require growth policy amendments, which are actually pretty common. So with that, I'll stand by for questions. I ask a do not pass. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. I think we have one more online. LaVale Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is LaVale Means, and the last name is spelled M-E-A-N-S. I'm with the City of Missoula, and I've been involved in developing a lot of growth policies. I'm here today to ask you to vote against this bill. This bill will substantially slow down the ability to represent emerging issues, creates uncertainty in the development process, and hampers the ability to efficiently correct language and mapping in the growth policy on a specific as-needed basis, because every amendment would be subject to establishing and waiting for a vote of the general electors that are within our entire study area. This, as growth policies are the framework for zoning, if growth policy fails, so would the zoning tools, and so would other concepts like an expedited subdivision review process that you heard about a little earlier today. This bill assumes that the current process of developing a growth policy does not involve a broad participation and awareness, community input and review. Missoula's recent experience with growth policy work is proof of the opposite. It included direct contact with over 2,000 people. It involved over 70 events and spread the word through media to thousands more. It sought quality input by including citizens working for months in writing the community policies directly. But this bill puts the emphasis on process at the end of a project rather than the beginning and throughout. This bill takes away the power of the planning board and the governing body to make the determinations that engagement was broad and considerate when they provide recommendations and final approval. Requiring a vote on a growth policy should generally not be able to supplant the quality engagement, participation, and understanding of a growth policy. And I fear that's where that would head. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Means. Are there any other opponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. The questions from the committee. Oh, what's up? Oh, yeah. Informational witnesses in the room. Informational witnesses online.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Questions from the committee. Seeing none. Oh, you have one? Representative Gist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will go for Ms. Lynch, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gist, I shouldn't have made eye contact.
Bad move. So I'm just looking on and amendments for coordination with cooperative federal agency 76-1-607. It's in the growth policy CMA. So if there's a growth policy, the governing body may be amended to, the governing body may amend the growth policy to include any elements required by federal land management agencies, established coordinating agency statutes. So does that mean that these growth policies, as needed, can be amended at any time with public involvement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gist, yes. Under existing law, yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Other questions for the committee? Seeing none, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would just respond to, obviously, every objection is to the change that I heard. It's amazing how a non-regulatory growth policy passed by this body a number of years ago is all of a sudden being regulatory. It's clear that the commission or the city council or whatever can do anything they want to do because they're elected people within law. They don't need the growth policy, but all of a sudden the federal government has said you got to have this, you got to have that. As far as the grants and subdivisions, on one opposition witness says you got a growth policy right now. Just because it isn't refreshed every day, you still got the growth policy. And I think that it'll reduce housing costs. What it will do as a rural landowner is that the county, in my case, can dump a bunch of regulations on top of you. They can say you got to have your barn red. They can use all those other things. I think it's onerous. I think it's imperative to me that the growth policy needs to be approved by the people. I think it's important for the elected bodies to write a growth policy that gives a little flexibility. I don't think you should have to amend a growth policy just because you have a 300 house development. I like it. I think a lot of the commissioners in my world have had two hearings attended by very few people, and they made the decision. And I think it's wrong, as I said before. That's why I brought this bill to it. I'm amenable to some amendments, so thank you.
All right, thank you, Representative. This ends the hearing on House Bill 369. Just a couple little brief announcements. I'm not going to abuse you anymore next week. I think we only have a one bill scheduled, but we have enough EAs to take up 2 days. So we'll try and catch all the way up on EAs and do one bill. And I'm not going to schedule any more next week, okay? All right. Yeah. Oh, I'm not. Okay, we're adjourned. I don't have any. We don't have any schedule to do it. Just one, maybe? One new house. Okay.